On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Peter Hessler writes heartbreakingly beautiful accounts of the flesh and blood people behind the astonishing boom of China. In his first book, the best-selling River Town, he brought to life his years of teaching in Fuling, China, deep in Sichuan Province. Now, having spent most of the last decade at the planet's hottest address, he's expanded his canvas to China's farthest reaches, deep into its history, and, again, deep into Chinese lives, the lies and compromises and dreams and breakneck change that engulf China today, life by life. Up next on Point, writer Peter Hessler and his new book, Oracle Bones, on the deep currents behind booming China. Joining me now from Seattle is Peter Hessler, Beijing correspondent for The New Yorker magazine, contributor to National Geographic. He's author of the best-selling Rivertown, 2 years on the Yangtze. His new book is Oracle Bones, A Journey Between China's Past and Present. Peter Hessler, welcome. Wonderful to have you.
Thanks. It's wonderful to be on the show.
I have to compliment you right off the bat. This is kind of home turf for me, second home turf, and your writing about it over the years has just been fabulous. I'm so glad that you're out there and doing it. Maybe tell us, just first of all, we understand the Peace Corps took you in the first place, but you've spent the better part of a decade in China now. What kept you there?
Right. I mean, it wasn't what I expected. I mean, it's funny when I look back because I joined the Peace Corps at 27, and when you're 27, a two-year commitment seems like an eternity. I mean, that seemed like it seemed so intimidating at that time to know that I was going to be there for 2 years, and now it's been 10. You know, I think it's partly a matter of the right place at the right time. It's just the way that there is so much energy in China right now. There is a sense of a place transforming itself. It's fascinating to live there. And as a writer, it's also gotten a lot easier, I believe, to work there. I think if I had shown up in China 5 years earlier than I had, or certainly 10 years earlier, I simply wouldn't have been able to talk to people as, you know, at the level that I've been able to. It was very hard in those days for foreigners to be in China and to have good access to Chinese people. And I think the society has become much more open, so that's also helped.
You're back in the U.S. now. You're talking about your new book, Oracle Bones. It must be immediately apparent to you that China is very much on the minds of Americans, very much in American headlines these days. And, of course, President Hu was just here. What's your sort of top-level impression of what it is that Americans don't get about China from their great distance in the headlines, in the press coverage?
Well, I think it's great that people are interested. There was, I mean, actually, when I first, when I wrote Rivertown and that book was first sent to publishers, I wrote it just on my own on speculation. And when I sent it to publishers, a number of people responded by saying, well, I don't think Americans want to read a book about China. That was back in 1999. And I think that's changed a lot. I mean, I think Americans realize this is an important place and there is a growing interest. I think that generally the picture that we get of China in America tends to be quite extreme. I think we sort of either see the worst of China or the very best of China. And I think that what we sort of miss is the middle. You know, in some ways, this is probably natural. It's the same way that I see the Chinese looking at America. I mean, when I lived in China as a teacher and now as a writer, I often hear Chinese people telling me how America is wonderful. It's like a paradise. Everybody there is free. Or I hear other Chinese telling me America is terrible. It's a country that invades other countries and wants to dominate the world. And you sort of have these extremes. And I've always found myself in China trying to push people, you know, toward a more realistic view of what America is. And I think it's the same looking in the other direction. The issue is basically when you're looking at something from far away, you know, when we're in America, China is an idea. It's not necessarily a place or you know, people. And I think my goal as a writer has been to sort of bring more of the texture out there and you know, and also give some sense of what average lives in China are like.
You're very clear that you're not trying to give the last word on China, the major sum up here, that it's the texture and the individual lives you're pointed at. But in this new book, Oracle Bones, you're also pointed very literally at Chinese history in a very big sweep. You open the book talking about how
Westerners for many years saw China as essentially not having history in Western terms, that it was a kind of just day after day, timeless China. You quote James Harrison Wilson writing in the 1880s saying they have stood absolutely still in knowledge since the Middle Ages. You've got a lot of very intimate personal stories in here, but then history alongside. Why did you decide to weave the two together?
Well, it is partly because when I was going back and looking at some of these early foreign commentaries about China, it was striking how different it was, first of all. I mean, especially that 19th century perspective. Foreigners saw China as a place that simply had not changed, and history had simply gone in circles. Nothing happened. You know, there is a famous German historian who described the Chinese as the people of eternal standstill. You know, the sense was that this place had not developed technologically. The political systems had not changed, emperor after emperor, dynasty after dynasty. And it's really amazing when you read that from the current perspective, when you see China is, if you're going to use one word to define it, it's transformation, it's change. So that fascinated me. And also just living in China, this is a place where history is fundamentally important. It means a great deal to the Chinese people. It's probably the most powerful element of their culture, this sense of history, the importance of history, and the sense of historical continuity. And I felt like as a writer, if I was going to write seriously about China, I needed to find a way to describe the history, to give Americans some sense of what that meant.
You're looking very literally at oracle bones here, bones that were heated and then the cracks were read millennia ago in China. We'll talk in more depth about that, but I wish you'd read us a little bit about the intersection of oracle bones and the sense of history. On page 143, there's a passage, I think, that conveys that pretty nicely. You might set it up and read it for us.
Okay. Yeah, I'll read from that section. The oracle bones appeared during a crisis that ran far deeper than politics or economics. By the early 20th century, foreign armies had proved to be far more powerful than the Chinese, and foreign political systems were certainly more efficient. But some Chinese intellectuals believed that even history was a Western advantage. Westerners perceived change as natural. The pharaohs disappeared, Greece collapsed, Rome fell. Without the weight of a continuous history and the conservatism of Confucianism, Westerners seemed more likely to look ahead. And rather than being short-sighted, tonight there would be no disasters. The Western view of the future expected tangible, long-term progress. Western history was also more fluid. There had been key moments during which Europeans had transformed their culture through an infusion of ancient values, half familiar and half foreign, like the Renaissance and the neoclassical age of enlightenment. Even archaeology fit neatly into the Western tradition of change. In 19th century Europe, the new discipline of archaeology was dominated by the rising middle class, whose descriptions of ancient ages, from stone to bronze to iron, reflected a modern faith and material progress. In China, though, intellectuals looked back and saw nothing but more Chinese history. Emperors and dynasties, the endless spiral of time. At the turn of the century, the culture suddenly felt suffocating, and radicals proposed doing away with almost everything traditional. In the early 1900s, one group of Chinese intellectuals called themselves the Doubting in Antiquity School, because they questioned the traditional historical texts that had been copied and studied repeatedly throughout the ages. To these skeptics, early dynasties such as the Xia and the Shang lacked evidence. The intellectuals perceived history as a trap, a set of hidebound traditions that had prevented China from modernizing. These doubters dismissed the oracle bones as forgeries.
Peter Hessler, reading from his new book, Oracle Bones. Remind us exactly what the oracle bones were. Who used them? How they were used? You quote from some of the things written on them. What were they?
The objects themselves are scraps of bone and shell. And 3,000 years ago, there was a culture in central China, what's now central China, and this culture was known as the Shang. And they performed divination ceremonies, coordinated and even interpreted often by the emperor, and he would crack these bones somehow in some sort of ceremony. Nobody knows exactly how, but they would divine what was going to happen in the immediate future. Is it going to rain tonight? Will my child be a boy or a girl? And then the results of these divinations were inscribed into the bones themselves, carved into the bones. And this is the first known writing in East Asia, and it didn't reappear until around 1900, this moment that I was describing, the sort of that they happened to return at this moment of historical crisis.
That is, the bones emerged. Archaeologists got their hands on them.
Right. People, you know, for 3,000 years, nobody had been aware of them. They had been forgotten. They were buried. And then they began to turn up. And people began to study them. And one thing that's quite striking is that the moment they reappeared, Chinese scholars could begin to read them, which is so different from, say, hieroglyphics. Hieroglyphics were around for more than a millennium before anybody could read them. It wasn't mm-hmm. until the Rosetta Stone was discovered that anybody could interpret them, because, of course, it was a very different writing system than what anybody was using at the time. But Chinese writing has changed so relatively little that even this writing from 3,000 years ago could still be read, which gives us an insight into just how this continuity was created. I mean, this is a culture that has been remarkably stable in certain respects, and the writing system is one of them.
Peter Hessler, you bring us above all these individual stories, and we don't want to miss what we can learn there. I wish you'd begin to introduce us to the cast of characters that you bring to Oracle Bones. Take us in here. William Jefferson, not Clinton, but Foster in China. Who is this? What can we learn?
Well, he was a former student of mine. When I was first in China, I was there with the Peace Corps, and I was teaching students in a small city. And most of my students had come from the rural areas, often from quite poor backgrounds. And Willie was one of these kids who was from a very remote village. And actually, almost everybody in his village was illiterate. His parents had never been to school even for a day. They couldn't read or write. And this kid had excelled in school. The family had made sacrifices to send him to good schools. And now he was in college. And not only was he in college, but he was learning a foreign language. He was learning English.
Where did he get this name, William Jefferson Foster? I mean, that's a long way from his Chinese name, no doubt.
Well, they all named themselves. I mean, when they began studying English, they chose names. And originally he was Willie. And then I think he noticed that I had a full Chinese name. I had a Chinese surname and a Chinese given name, and so he decided that he wasn't going to be left out, and he became William Foster, and then shortly after that he became William Jefferson Foster.
Do you recall offhand his Chinese name?
Dai Xiaohong. Yeah, that's his Chinese name.
And your Chinese name, Peter Hessler?
My Chinese name is Huo Wei, and again, this is just a name that was given to me the moment I arrived in China in the Peace Corps. And, of course, I had no idea what it meant or that I would be carrying it around for 10 years. And it's a funny name because it's a very basic. It's sort of like John Smith. When I taught at the college, there were three people with my name, three Huo Weis. And, you know, when I go in Beijing to the place where I rent cars, it's always a hassle because there's two other people with the same name.
So here's William Jefferson Foster, self-taken English name. He's working hard, listening to Voice of America, a Chinese man in a boom time. What is it in his story that we have to be paying attention to?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, one is simply the generation gap. I mean, this is a sense of, you really get a sense of movement when you visit somebody like Willie's village and visit his parents. I mean, his parents, as I said, were illiterate. Were simple farmers, and this boy is really in touch with so much more. And you realize just how wide the generation gap is in a society that is moving as fast as China is. And the other element is migration, but it's probably the most important social development in China of this generation, which right now, I guess the most recent statistic is that more than 140 million Chinese have left their rural homes and are looking for work and new lives in the sort of boomtown economies, mostly along the coastal regions. And this is just a massive change. I mean, social scientists say it's the largest peaceful migration in human history. And it occurs in a country that traditionally was quite agrarian and where relatively few people left their home. So it's a massive change, and this is what Willie did. Willie, after graduating from college, he headed east to seek his fortune, and a number of my students have done this.
Take us into that generation gap with his parents. What illustration can you give us from his life, from the life inside his family and household, of this generation gap yawning open in China today?
Well, a lot of it is simply economic. I mean, when I visit him where he lives, this is a fairly, well-developed area. He lives near a city called Wenzhou, which in China is famous for having, just a booming economy. It has the highest per capita income of any province in China. So you have good highways, new roads being built. It's just like a massive construction project. And you go back to his village, which I did one year, and it's still dirt roads. I went for a walk with his father, and we walked down to the river, and there was somebody there, you know, fishing with an otter that had a string tied around its neck. I mean, this was really very basic living standards there. You know, and again, the parents, you know, I think one element that you really notice is that when somebody like Willie runs into some issue or some problem, he really can't turn to his family. Even though he respects his parents and loves his parents, they simply haven't had these experiences that he's having. They haven't lived in a city like Wenzhou. You know, they haven't had to deal with what it means to study English or to teach in, you know, in a private school that's very competitive. So, you know, he has to turn to other sources. And I think that's one reason why he English is so important to him, one reason why he became obsessed with listening to things like the BBC and Voice of America. He's just trying to get as much information as possible. And he's also looking for some guidance, I think.
So he's living there in Wenzhou, south of Shanghai, looking back to his parents. Meanwhile, he's gone to the coast. He's riding the boom. They're still in the home village. Does he respect them? Does he respect what they stand for, the kind of timeless history that you were describing earlier? I mean, after all, this is the culture of ancestor worship, but he's part of the light-speed Chinese generation. How does he look at his forebears?
He certainly has a very deep respect for them. And I think one thing that he recognizes is that his parents are very intelligent. They're very, you know, they're very talented people, but they just didn't have much opportunity during their generation. They, you know, his father was born in 1941, which meant that he was a sort of a teenager during the Great Leap Forward. And some of his relatives and some of his friends starved to death during that time. That was an awful period when Mao's, you know, sort of crazed economic policies were resulting in famine, and particularly in Sichuan province.
And then came the Cultural Revolution. From. People really got beaten up.
Yeah, he never had a chance, you know, and so I think Willie respects this. He understands it. He's not dismissive of them at all. But I think it often makes him sad, and when he goes back home, that's often his reaction. I'll actually read briefly from one of his letters. When 1 year after he returned back to the village, he wrote me a letter, and he wrote, "When I am home, nothing has changed, and the roads are still rough, and people are getting older. It makes me sad that I cannot find familiar people or friends who I knew well when I was young. Sometimes I think this kind of life, going out to coastal regions without a stable home, is the saddest and most stressful thing in the world." And he's commenting in part on simply the fact that everybody of his generation is gone. And this is true when you go to many rural Chinese villages that there simply aren't young people there. They've all decided to leave to seek their fortune. And I've actually, even in the outskirts of Beijing, I've been to villages that are completely abandoned. I mean, a cluster of six or seven houses that at one point was a small community. Now it's empty. And the walls are rotting away. It's very eerie, you know, but it's very striking as well. And it really, you know, really helps you understand just the pace of change. Because many of these places, I step inside and you can read the wallpaper because they wallpaper with newspapers in the countryside.
Right.
And the headlines are from the 1980s, and you realize it's not that long ago, you know. But it's like a massive change that's happened in the space of 15 years.
Everybody on the Move introduces to a couple of more. Emily, another former student of yours in one of the most booming factory towns, and tuning into the radio there to try to get advice from a kind of familiar voice there from talk show hosts. There's a reading I wonder if you'd do for us on page 93 about her life. You should set up where she is, what she's up to, how typical she is, and then if you could read some of that for us, Peter Hessler.
Right. Emily was another student who left home, and she went to Shenzhen, which is probably the most famous of the Chinese boom towns. This was a place where in the early 1980s, the Chinese government they designated it as an economic laboratory and as literally an experimental city. And
just up the river from Hong Kong there.
Right, close to Hong Kong. And it was a place that in the past had been sort of undeveloped because they were afraid of Hong Kong. They didn't want to have a big city near Hong Kong because it could get contaminated. But then, of course, when they reached the reform era after 1978, it was like a flip-flop. And suddenly they decided, okay, we want to learn from the outside world. And one thing we want to do is to have cities where we try new policies, and particularly free market economy policies. Right. And Shenzhen was designated as such. And so this was where they had the first free labor markets and the first relatively free real estate markets and so on. And the place boomed. It became a hotspot for foreign direct investment. Infrastructure was built, new factories turned up, and millions of migrants moved there, and the city went from countryside to, you know, to becoming a big city.
Yeah.
Along the way, it sort of became demographically a very unusual place. It's mostly young women, because many of these factories prefer to hire women because they believe that they're easier to control. They can pay them less than men. So many of the factory owners believe that women are better workers for them. And it's also incredibly young. The average age is less than 29 down there. When you go, you're struck by how few older people you see, and even how few children, because many of these people have not yet married. If they do marry and have children, they often have the kids back in the provinces, back in their village home.
And they're churning out what fills Walmart. Read for us there something about Emily's life in that realm.
Right. I'm describing a visit that I made to Shenzhen in 1999. That night, we ate dinner at an outdoor restaurant near Emily's factory. In Chinese cities, evening was often the most pleasant time of the day, and this was especially true in Shenzhen, where dusk finally made the place seem human. The monotony of the factory towns was brutal in daylight, and the streets seemed abandoned during working hours. But in the evenings, when most work shifts ended, there was a sudden rush of young people outside the factory walls. They moved in excited groups, like schoolchildren after the final bell. Sitting at the restaurant, I watched them walk past on the sidewalk, talking, laughing, flirting. Apart from their jobs, they had few obligations in this place. No families, no traditions. In that sense, they were free. During dinner, Emily regaled me with stories about the factory owners. One of her boss's colleagues was a Chinese-American who, after recently arriving from San Francisco on business, had gone to Emily's office, faxed his wife a love letter, and then immediately gone out and hired a prostitute. Emily's own boss was always leering at the young woman in the factory, and most of his friends were the same. In a nearby plant, another Taiwanese owner had become so distracted by his two Sichuanese mistresses that his company had gone bankrupt. Emily laughed as she told the stories, and I imagined how quickly they circulated among young women who lived 10 to a dorm room. Before coming to Shenzhen, Emily had never imagined that people acted this way. She told me that one of her biggest surprises had been receiving an update about her fooling neighbor, the young woman who had always been portrayed as a great Shenzhen success. Emily's sister had learned, in fact, that the woman was a second wife to a factory owner from Hong Kong. Emily had little respect for the businessmen who came to Shenzhen, especially the Taiwanese. Her boyfriend, Zhu Yunfeng, had recently left the jewelry factory for a new job, where he worked under a Taiwanese who treated employees fairly. But in Emily's opinion, that kind of boss was the exception, and most of the others were exploitative and sex-crazed. All of them have failed somewhere else, she scoffed, explaining that her boss's old company in Taiwan had gone bankrupt years ago. When I asked about the political climate, she said that Shenzhen had fewer government restrictions than her hometown. But she pointed out that labor practices could be just as limiting. Here it's not the government, but the bosses who control everything, she said. Maybe it amounts to the same thing.
Peter Hessler, reading from his new book, Oracle Bones, taking us into the fabric of Chinese life there in the booming factory town just up the way from Hong Kong. Peter Hessler, a lot of listeners want to join us. I want to begin to invite them in. Rainbow's calling from Boston. Hi, Rainbow. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Yes. And I just, my a little comment. I'm Chinese. Mm-hmm. Gay from mainland China.
Mm-hmm.
And then educated in Australia, in America.
What year did you leave China, Rainbow?
When I was 2 years old, many 70. And okay. These people, like, we are starving by a little boat.
Mm-hmm.
We escaped by a little boat, and we almost get caught by the government.
So how do you see it now?
And now I'm a successful scientist. Actually, many, many Chinese students come to America, become successful scientists, and they chose to stay in America. And my point I want to make is that Chinese biotech, you know, I'm a biotech scientist, I can only say about biotech. I think that most companies go back to China because they think cheap, cheap, cheap. Everything is cheap.
Yep.
But in fact, I think Chinese biotech shouldn't be just like the low-cost labor.
And biotech, biotechnology, I see, okay.
Exactly. But right now, is you know, all the new drug discovery, all Chinese has extremely, understanding the need for innovation and higher standard in the discovery. So the government put tons of money into Shanghai and Beijing.
Yeah.
But my question is that I was wondering why not China using Hong Kong as a gateway, because Hong Kong, you know, under British rule and all the IP, excellent IP, excellent infrastructure and human capital.
So why not use it more? Rainbow, I'll put that to Peter Hester, but let me ask you while we've got you.
Why using Hong Kong as a gateway to mainland China?
We'll ask, but let me ask you, when you look at China now, you left decades ago, are you proud of China? Are you bursting with pride? Do you think it looks healthy?
I think that we most Chinese people should go back to help them. We should all go back to help them, to give them the chance for the next generation to enjoy what we have, the freedom.
Peter Hessler, Rainbow says, why doesn't Hong Kong or China turn to Hong Kong to open up a step beyond cheap industry and to get into a higher tier realm there? And then overseas Chinese need to go home. Does China need them, Peter?
Well, I think that Hong Kong traditionally was seen as the way to get into China, and it certainly still plays a really critical role, although that does seem to be changing. It's something that weighs on people in Hong Kong. They see now that for example, Shanghai is becoming more of the business center, and it's probably inevitable that happens.
Mojo's moving there.
Yeah. So I think that is underway. As far as Chinese returning, I mean, I think this is also happening. There was a period when very, very few Chinese who were educated in America would return home, because if they went back, then they would work, in a government work unit, and probably they would have a supervisor who was jealous that they had been able to go overseas and had experiences that he or she had not had. And often they would essentially be punished or be held back in various ways. But now a lot of them who go back are in the private economy. They're no longer working for state-owned enterprises. And in the private economy, if you're Microsoft or you're Motorola, you don't want to waste talent. And so if you've got people who are well-educated and have skills, you use them. And so I think people, now many Chinese, go back with more confidence that their new skills will be used in a positive way. I think this sense that Rainbow mentioned, the sense of obligation to China is a really powerful thing. And it's always amazing to me how many Chinese who have left and sometimes have been gone for a generation will still feel a sense of obligation. It's something that China has benefited from at many points during history, and I think we're seeing it now in this generation as well.
Brian's calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to get your author's perspective on this question. I don't think that the Chinese people and the American people have conflicting interests at all. But I don't think that the interests are being served by the current global paradigm, where the American workers are being displaced by what I would argue amounts to virtually slave-made goods. And I don't think that the Chinese people's interests are being served by being asked to, feed America's insatiable appetite for their cheap goods. And also, I don't think their interests are being served by us pretending they're not a totalitarian society and have their faith or speak their mind. And I think that we Americans should not be dealing with the Chinese government at the level that we're dealing with them, giving them most favored nation trading status and more or less allowing them to dump goods that are really don't have the true cost of production built into them. They don't have the retirement and the health care of the Chinese people built into those goods.
Brian, we hear it. You broke up a little bit there, but Peter Hessler, you hear the question, and Brian was saying through the rough cell phone there for a minute, pointing out that these are people who do not have the civil rights and liberties that Americans are accustomed to, yet we're happy to take the output from their factories. How do you respond to that perspective, that this ought to be a great relationship, but it may not be at its most healthy right now? Peter Hessler.
Well, I think it's true that most Americans would not want to work in Chinese factories. And I think American workers would not be very happy if they were put into a Chinese factory. But the issue here is really one of perspective, and I think it really is relative. We can't expect American standards to be applied across the board all around the world. And, I mean, the truth is that when you spend time in Chinese factories and you spend time in Chinese villages, the first thing you realize is that people want to work. You know, I would not use the word slave labor to describe what's going on in China. These are, you know, people willingly leave their villages, often at great investment as far as buying tickets and taking the risk of leaving home. And they're taking these jobs willingly. They want to do it. They're not being starved off the land. I mean, they could stay in the countryside, but they leave for opportunity. You know, and the conditions in the factory often are not up to American standards. And, you know, and there were certainly many cases of brutality and of terrible things happening. But the truth is that this is a place where they saw worse 10 years ago. For most people, this is an improvement. It's a step ahead. And I think the other factor is that people who work in these factories are looking ahead to better things. One thing that's remarkable is when you go to these factory towns, just the sheer volume of sort of self-help classes that develop around these places. I mean, there's, you know, thousands of factory workers enroll in evening English courses, or they learn to type, or they're always trying to pick up some skill to move up the ladder. It's not so much that a Chinese person goes to the factory and just does the same job, making minimal pay, and is satisfied with that. It is aspirational. And, you know, I have spent a lot of time there, and I've seen, you know, some terrible things and heard some terrible stories. But my overall impression is that people willingly go, and they go because they believe it improves their lives. Mm-hmm. And I sort of feel like that's their decision to make. I feel like as an American, I don't have the right to tell them what they should value, you know, what they need to demand, and it's up to them to, you know, to make those choices.
Do you have the sense, Peter Hessler, that Chinese people, and of course that refers to a billion plus now, so there are many perspectives here, but you described in general the kind of timelessness of history they were part of for such a long time. Are they self-aware of breaking out of that now? How do you see their pride, their expectations? Is there a sense of ascendancy? We're on a roll. We're going somewhere brand new for China?
Certainly there is at the national level. I mean, I think the government is aware of this, and often Chinese intellectuals are aware of this. I think the interesting thing is that the average Chinese people, the sort of, I guess you can sort of define them as the new middle class, or the people that are going to become the middle class. These are often migrants or people who are trying to work their way up in factory jobs or in, you know, sort of lower level white collar jobs. The interesting thing is that I think it's their goal and their inspiration is more individual. They are driven by their own desires and by the desire to help their family do better, to improve themselves, to improve their lives. And, you know, in some sense, I think this is much easier for a person to deal with instead of feeling the weight of a nation on their back. This is what we often saw in the early part of the 20th century, is that Chinese, and in particular Chinese intellectuals, felt like we have to turn our country around.
Yeah.
How can we save China? And, of course, it never worked. And, you know, how can you possibly, you know, as a human being, function with that sort of weight? And the truth is that they made the change when, in 1978, Deng Xiaoping just simply turned to pragmatism and said, let individuals do what they want to do in terms of finding work, leaving home, you know, finding new lives. You know, and certainly these, it's not as if people were given complete freedom, but step by step, people were allowed to make more decisions for themselves and were allowed to change their lives in certain key ways.
You quote this terrific spring story, the official song of Shenzhen you were talking about earlier, talking about Deng Xiaoping doing that. Here's the song that sung: in the spring of 1979, an old man drew a circle on the southern coast of China, and city after city rose up like fairy tales, and mountains of gold gathered like a miracle. Is it, I mean, it's communist China, but you're talking about sort of just the market energy, one by one, pulling people into aspiration and pulling the country up here?
Yeah, I think it's also the rise of the individual. That's what we're beginning to see at sort of an early level, and I think that is, at the bottom line, that's what has inspired this change. It was certainly a change in government policies, a dramatic change, but it depended on people making these decisions and starting businesses or finding jobs, leaving home. You know, and I think that's an incredibly important development. People who are in China beginning to see themselves as individuals and beginning to, you know, to find their own place in the world. That's one of the reasons that I am quite interested in English study in China as well, because I see that also as part of the same process, gaining a new perspective on where they fit in.
It's a big deal when individuals begin to stand up. Josh is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Josh, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is about environmental degradation. I've been reading a lot about the, you know, rapid economic development in China, And one of the things that most kind of worries me is the degradation of the ground and the surface waters and the soils. That's making it seems to be making it more and more difficult for even people far out in the provinces to grow kind of healthy food and to live a traditional lifestyle with the cities and factories that seem to be creeping farther out. I'm wondering what your kind of firsthand perspective is on that, and if there's any hope for that being reined in, because we know that these kind of changes can happen very quickly, but the environmental effects can linger for decades, if not centuries.
Yeah, Peter.
I think this is a, you know, a major problem in China. This is something that does concern me, and I'm often disturbed by what I see. And, you know, I first of all, just living in Beijing, the quality of air has really gotten worse year by year, particularly since 2002, 2003, with the boom in automobiles. I think one of the problems here is that China, for most of the 20th century, pretty much for all the 20th century, was a very unstable place. You had all sorts of political upheavals. You had wars. You had massive campaigns like the Great Leap Forward or the Cultural Revolution. And what happens to people in this sort of environment is they develop a short-term perspective. You try to survive, and if there are opportunities, you take them immediately. And it doesn't encourage people to think long-term. And I think this becomes a problem in particular with the environment. And I think it's very hard for Chinese at this moment to say, you know, well, maybe we need to slow down, or maybe we need to make some decisions that aren't in our immediate short-term interest, but they're going to be better for us long-term. You know, the climate simply has not prepared people for that. So it does concern me. I think this is a real problem. I don't know, you know, and as far as a solution, I think it's very hard because of this historical background. You know, what has led to this point has really created what could be a catastrophe for the environment.
A billion people grabbing it while they can. There's one more personality in this book that I really do not want to miss. Polat, the sort of outlaw Chinese profile here in Oracle Bones, Peter Hessler. Introduce this very unusual, wonderful man for us.
Well, he was somebody who I met near the neighborhood where I lived in Beijing, and he's actually a Uyghur, which is one of the minorities who live in China, and his particular ethnic group is from the far west of China, in a place called Xinjiang, which most people have never heard of. It's massive. It's the size of Alaska and New York combined, and it's in Central Asia, borders Kazakhstan and Russia and Mongolia and Tibet to the south. And this has often been a restive province. They've often been very uneasy with their relationship to the Chinese, and then really they only became part of the Chinese Empire in sort of a more firm way in the 19th century. And there have been a lot of political problems there. And this was somebody I met.
And overwhelmingly Islamic, Muslim.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And so they are sort of on the margins of China. They are Chinese. A Uyghur carries a Chinese passport, but his language is Turkic. He does not look Chinese. He looks Central Asian, often Middle Eastern. And they often, you know, are not happy about Chinese control of what they see as their homeland, very similar to the Tibetans.
You tell this story from, it was May 1999, that American planes bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And, of course, there was a tremendous, this was when NATO was intervening in the Balkans, tremendous uproar in China about that. I wish you'd set the scene for us a little bit, how you first met Polat, this little tiny restaurant you were in where you were feeling the heat as an American, and he came to your aid. What were the kind of remarks you were getting from your Chinese companions or the folks eating around you that night, and how did Polat rescue you?
Well, it was a very sensitive time, and this is a period that fortunately did not last very long, but for a little more than a week, it was you know, it didn't feel necessarily safe on the street, and Chinese people would become quite angry. They would come up to you as a foreigner and ask you why this had happened. Why do foreign countries always attack China? What is your reason? Where are you from? You know, and I sort of was trying to avoid these interactions as much as possible. And so I was hanging out in a part of town where there were a lot of Russian traders and a lot of Central Asians, a lot of people who were non-Chinese. And I was actually going to Islamic restaurants because I felt like I was less likely to be sort of criticized there because, of course,
as an American,
the people who were Islamic also had a very different perspective on NATO's campaign. I mean, they saw that as a campaign that was in support of Islamic people. And, you know, I was at one of these restaurants and some Chinese were there and they began to give me a hard time and ask me why this had happened. And I always tried to say, look, you know, I don't know. I'm just an average person. This I don't really understand what's going on there either. That wasn't enough. They continued to push. And finally, this other man who was eating there.
Well, and they were saying to you, I love this, Peter, excuse me, but they were saying, if America's so darned advanced, how could it bomb this Chinese embassy by mistake? I mean, that's impossible. That's ridiculous.
Over and over you heard that. Over and over. You know, if America is the most powerful country in the world, why did this happen? How could they possibly have made a mistake? That doesn't make any sense at all. And, you know, to a degree, they had a point. I mean, NATO claimed that they had used an outdated map.
Yeah.
And how is this possible with this sort of military? Of course, I think now we have a new perspective on the competence of the military and the competence of the CIA. I mean, that was back in 1999. But at that time, this was something you heard a lot. And this Uyghur sort of broke in and said, well, you know, if America wanted to kill Chinese, don't you think they would have killed more than three? You know, which is an incredibly inflammatory statement.
Subversive in the middle of Beijing.
Right. I mean, you know, and at that point, the heat moved away from me and toward him. So that was how we first met. And then we spent a lot of time together. And as I grew to know him, I realized that he had had political problems in the past. He had been a dissident, had spent time in prison, and now he was working sort of as a middleman, as a trader, using his language skills. But his dream was to go to the United States.
Which he eventually did, ended up delivering Chinese food in Washington, D.C., and that wasn't exactly this Chinese Uyghur outlaw's dream life either.
Right. I mean, you know, the book sort of tracks his story is woven throughout the book, and it was, you know, because he went to America in 2000, and he went illegally, actually, and it was really, you know, it was something that I had no idea. When he talked about this, I never thought he was serious about it, and then suddenly he had all of the paperwork, and in China you can kind of do this. In many places you can do this, as we learned, you know, in 9/11. I mean, it's possible to get all kinds of identification, all
fake
kinds
IDs,
of
pay the right
documents.
People, and pretty soon
you're on your way
to America.
Yeah, if it cost him $8,800, you know, the 2/8 are because it was for good fortune, good luck going overseas, you know. But he ended up going, and of course he arrived, and he was fortunate to receive political asylum. He did have a legitimate political case, and he received asylum at the beginning of 2001, and that was basically just in time for 9/11. So then he's a non-English-speaking Central Asian immigrant in Washington, D.C. And so, you know, he moved from the peripheries of China to sort of the peripheries of the United States. And in a way, sort of knowing this person and watching, you know, sort of knowing him through these years and watching him move from one country to another, I began to think more seriously about, you know, what do these big cultures mean? And in particular, what is it like if you're outside? And what is it like for somebody who's a Uyghur or somebody who's an immigrant? You know, it sort of gave me a new perspective on not only China, but on the United States.
Peter, we've just got a couple of minutes here. You mentioned 9/11. On that day, you saw a lot of Chinese in the days following the 9/11 attacks treating this as though it was about time America got some comeuppance. How do you see the relationship between these two great nations unfolding as you look at it through the eyes of individual Chinese looking on here?
Well, I think these places are more similar than we might think. I mean, I think both China and the United States are, you know, they're just massive countries with an incredibly powerful sense of unity, I mean, an incredibly powerful sense of culture. The patriotism is really, I think I've never been to any other place in the world that is more patriotic than China or than the United States. And in the same sense, I think they are very wrapped up in themselves, and each country has a lot of trouble dealing with the outside world. And it's natural. I mean, both of them are somewhat isolated geographically, but I think also simply the power of the culture makes it difficult to see outside yourself. And it's interesting. I mean, and both of them experienced a trauma at some point. I mean, I think the Chinese trauma was infinitely deeper when you look at the Opium War and what happened to China from the 19th to the 20th centuries, the sense of being attacked. And the U.S. has undergone its own trauma. And so for both of them, that is the central issue. How do we deal with the outside world?
Much in common if we can see each other over each other's backyard fence. You are terrific Periscope for doing that, and we're very grateful for it. Peter Hessler, author of Oracle Bones, his latest book, and a really terrific read on China. Peter, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Download the On Point podcast and subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.com. www.onpointchina.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.